This is Audible.
Brilliance Audio presents the unabridged recording of The Mermaid's Sister by Carrie Ann Noble. Performed by Kate Rudd. For my sister, Kate. Safe in the arms of her true father, but missed every day. Chapter 1. Lanfair Mountain, Pennsylvania, 1870. Wishing gets you nothing. These words are old wounds carved into the trunk of an ancient tree. Above the vandal's warning, the tree stretches evergreen limbs across the glassy surfaced wishing pool. Below, its dark roots twist and trail into the water. Do trees make wishes? I do not think so. But I am wishing. I wish that my sister would come out of the water. I can see her resting on the perfect round pebbles at the bottom of the pool, the ones tossed in by visitors over hundreds of years, the ones said to be required by the pool sprite as payment. One perfect pebble for each wish. Such pebbles are rare in the world, as rare as magic itself. Bubbles rise from Marin's mouth, each one slowly drifting to the surface before popping. Her eyes are closed, her body is as still as a corpse. Little gray fishes nibble at the fabric of her floating petticoat. As she dreams, her webbed toes twitch and a smile spreads across her face. She never looks so happy on the land. Come out, I say, knowing she will not, even if she does hear me. She never obeys me. Behind me, twigs crack and leaves rustle. I turn to see our wyvern lifting one foot and then the other, fussing at the moss and sticks between his bird-like toes. His blue scales, pale as a summer sky on his belly and dark as midnight on his back, catch the dim light like curved slices of stained glass. He nods his dragony head and snorts. Auntie has sent him to bring us home for supper, no doubt. Good luck, Osbert, darling, I say. She's only been in for an hour. Osbert spreads his wings wide and dives nose first into the pool with barely a splash. When he reappears, he brings Marin with him, his sharp teeth clutching the back of her camisole like an enormous mother dog carrying a naughty puppy by the nape of its neck. When he releases her, she crumples onto the muddy shore. Osbert tickles her neck with his barbed tail and snorts encouragement over her motionless body. Finally, she awakens with a gasp, sits up, and swats at the watchful wyvern. Go home, you beast! Osbert's ears flatten and he skulks away, whining. He thinks he saved your life, I say. You could be kinder to him. She does not speak again until we are halfway home, at the place where the forest and meadow meet. She plucks a cornflower from its stalk and says quietly, Someday I will stay in the water. Someday I won't come out. My heart sinks down, down. I can think of no reply. She tosses the flower away and says, Will you visit me, Clara, when I live in the sea with my mermaid sisters? Will you come in a boat and bring me cherries from Auntie's tree? Will you come and sing our songs? Will you bring O'Neill? What about Osbert? You may leave this silly wyvern at home, but you must promise to come. She reaches for my hand. Her webbed fingers are still dripping with wishing pool water. They are more webbed than they were last summer. I stare at them, my sister's strange fingers. Until our 16th birthday, she had hands like mine. Same size, same shape, same chipped nails stained with tree sap or mud, ink or dyes. Twin hands, although we are not of the same blood. But now, her hands are changing. She is changing. I am losing her. I wish I would not. But wishing gets you nothing. With a long match, Auntie lights the three fat yellow candles in the center of the oaken kitchen table. The scent of beeswax mingles with the scents of vegetable stew and fresh bread. She waves the match in the air like a magic wand, and its flame transforms into a puff of white smoke. The smoke curls and stretches into a halo around Auntie's gray hair. Come and sit here, Merrin, Auntie says. Arms crossed, Merrin plods to the chair. She tosses her head and her honey-colored curls bounce about her slim shoulders. She casts a scowl my way to let me know that she knows I told on her. Auntie takes Merrin's pale hands in her plump, wrinkled ones, turns them this way and that, then holds them close to the candles, and she sighs. Now I know why you've taken to wearing gloves of late, Auntie says. Merrin's cheeks redden and she stares at the tablecloth. I should have expected the change to come quickly once you turned 16. I hope you will forgive an old woman for not being a better mother, for not better preparing you for what's to come. Now, is there anything else you should show me, Merrin? Auntie asks, releasing her hands. She lifts Merrin's chin so that she must meet her gaze. The truth, my dear. A few seconds pass before Merrin pulls her bodice away from the waistband of her skirt. She clutches the fabric so that her side is exposed. My, my, Auntie mutters. Beneath a layer of alabaster skin, I see rows of pale green scales, starting just at the dainty curve of Merrin's waist. Delicate scales, small and silver-edged. I am on my feet before I know it. I reach out and touch my sister's side, feeling the ridges. They are real. Not a trick of the light, as I'd hoped. I have kept my worries about Merrin to myself for too long. Auntie, I whisper, can you cure her? Should I fetch the remedy book? Auntie is famous among the folk of the mountain for the medicines she concocts from our herb gardens and the bounty of the forest. No, child. Auntie's voice is gentle but firm. You know I cannot. There is no cure for being who you truly are. But, Auntie, I cannot find words to form the 100 questions swirling in my head, my heart. We've been pretending, Auntie says, pretending that your sister's transformation was something yet to come, instead of something that has always been happening, bit by bit. But you can't erase a thing by not acknowledging it. Auntie places one hand on Merrin's shoulder and the other on mine. Your lives are wonders, my girls. They will be wonders from start to finish. Do you not remember the story of how you came to me? The seashell and the stork. You tell us every birthday, Merrin volunteers. Her smile is sweet and strained at the same time, beautiful and eerie. And can I lie? Auntie asks. Never, Merrin and I say in unison, knowing Auntie's part fairy blood keeps her from speaking falsely. Auntie smooths her flowered apron before perching her ample bottom on her favorite wooden stool. Shall I tell you again? Oh, yes, Merrin says, her eyes sparkling with delight. I nod. Perhaps, if I pay close attention to the story, the weight of my dread over Merrin's condition will lessen, at least for a little while. Placing her folded hands in her lap, Auntie begins. It was October, of course. Both of you came to me in October. The winds were fierce one night, rattling the windows and howling down the chimney like unhappy ghosts. Rain pelted the roof like rocks thrown by a family of giants. Osbert was in a state, moaning and pacing in front of the parlor fireplace. He kept tripping over my knitting basket and getting tangled in my good wool yarn. I was just about to banish him to the cellar when a knocking started at the kitchen door. I left Osbert in his tangle, a good place for him, as it kept him restrained so he couldn't scare the visitor. But when I opened the door, not a soul was there. "Yoo-hoo!" I called. "You're welcome to come in for a cup of tea. Nasty night this is." But no one answered. I was just about to shut the door when it caught my eye. A great conch shell just lying there on the path, like the tide had gone out without it. Never mind that no tide ever touches Lanfair Mountain. That seashell was as big as my good soup pot. I'd never seen the like. Being partial to seashells, I brought it inside and set it on this very table to admire it. It was wet with rain, so I used the hem of my apron to polish it dry. And when I tipped it, a tiny bundle rolled out onto the table. A little blanket woven of seaweed with the smallest face I'd ever seen peeking out. Here was a babe just as pink and white as the inside of the conch. She wore a little scallop shell on her head as a bonnet. That child was you, Merrin.
"I came from the sea, and to the sea I must return," Merrin says, as nonchalantly as one might say, 2 + 2 = 4.
"Indeed," Auntie says. "Did I ever tell you otherwise?"
"Never," Merrin says, looking quite pleased. "Now tell us about Clara."
Merrin pours tea into her mug and adds 2 teaspoons of salt, as is her habit. No one craves salt like our Merrin. "Well, it wasn't but 3 days later. I'd just put Merrin in her cradle for a nap. I went to the window to check the weather, because I'd hung my best quilt out to air and the red sky morning had promised rain. That's when I saw him. I stood stock still, and I watched him come closer and closer. The clouds slid a thick veil over the sun, and in the dimness his eyes shone like 2 bits of polished coal. He was carrying a cloth-covered bundle like it was the most precious thing in the world. I ran out to meet him, and he placed the gift in my arms.
"Beware of storks bearing gifts," Merrin says, poking me. I slap her arm in reply.
Auntie chuckles. "Let me finish, girls. As I was saying, I took that bundle in my arms and folded back the edge of the cloth to find another wee babe. Fast asleep you were, your black lashes lying against your cheeks like miniature raven's wings. A sister for Merrin," I said. When I looked up to thank him, he was gone.
"Who? Who was the one who brought me?"
I am desperate for a comforting answer. "Was it my true father?" She has never said so before, but perhaps today she might tell me more.
"No, not your father, dear. A stork brought you, Clara mine. You know this. The most beautiful stork I'd ever seen."
Raised with just enough magic to unquestioningly assume that someday I would become a stork, I had never before found the story particularly disturbing. But on this day, with the evidence of Merrin's transformation before my eyes and beneath my fingertips, I give way to panic. Trembling, I ask what I have not until now.
"Auntie, are you saying that one day I'll sprout wings like Merrin is sprouting scales?"
"I said nothing of the kind, Clara, my dear."
Auntie lovingly caresses the top of my head.
"You worry too much. Worrying gets you nothing."
"Like wishing," I say.
I slump in my chair and close my eyes.
"What I wish right now is that someone would see to the hens," Auntie says.
The discussion is clearly over.
"Go on, Clara. And you may fetch some firewood, Merrin."
"Yes, Auntie,"
we say together, like twins. We catch one another's eyes. In Merrin's, I can see the green blue of the ocean. A tide of sorrow rushes over my heart. The ocean is so very far away. How will I live without my sister? She is the strong one, the outgoing one, the shiny as a new coin one. The one the village boys smile at. The one who charms extra pennies from the shrewdest of housewives when we sell our vegetables in the square. What am I without her? Just a girl left by a stork. Chapter 2. Osbert races back and forth in front of the cottage, shrieking and galloping like a crazed two-legged miniature pony. His unruly pointed tail knocks the heads off the black-eyed Susans and tears up the grass by its roots. "Osbert, hush!" I say. "Go inside, you beast!" I do not know what has provoked him to act so wildly. It could be anything from a trespassing chipmunk to an approaching villager, and if it is the latter, he would do well to hide himself. Few people believe dragons still exist, especially not the practical folk of Lanfair Mountain. It is better for us all if his presence remains a secret. When I hear the clanging, I know why Osbert is in such a state. Scarf and O'Neill are coming, and Osbert loves no one better, not even Auntie, who raised him from an egg. Pots and pans bump and bang together as they swing from hooks under the eaves of the brightly painted house wagon, above the sign that reads, "Scarf and Brady, Merchants." Funny wind chimes made of old spoons and knives, chimes crafted from bits of pottery and sea glass, and chimes created from pieces of copper pipe and tin soldiers add their notes to the music of the caravan's approach. This symphony lifts my heart like no other, for it means the arrival of beloved friends. Auntie steps out of the cottage, a wide smile on her round face, the unmistakable smile of a woman in love. For as old as they might be now, my dear Auntie Verity and Ezra Scarf have been sweethearts, according to Auntie, since her hair was chestnut brown and his beard was the color of dandelions. From his seat behind his faithful horses, Job and January, Scarf waves with both hands. Before the caravan stops, a young man leaps out its back door, turns a somersault in the air, and lands squarely on two green-shoed feet. "O'Neill!" Marin shouts in a most unladylike fashion from across the garden. To reinforce her lack of manners, she runs to him and embraces him with such vigor that they both stumble and fall into the dusty road. I blush in embarrassment for my sister. She would not consider being embarrassed for herself. And then I pick up my skirts and hurry to meet O'Neill. "You've grown taller," I say as he regains his footing and brushes the dirt from his tan trousers and brightly embroidered vest. "Scarf tells me that he absolutely will not buy me another pair of trousers till next spring, even if they're at my knees come New Year's Day," the blonde young man says, laughing. He embraces me before I can object. Not that I would have, truly. He smells of spices and strong soap, like Christmas morning come early. "There now," he says, "now I am made welcome." Osbert leaps the garden gate and tackles O'Neill, licking his face with a forked and silvery tongue. "Ha," Marin says, "now you are made welcome indeed." She puts a hand over her mouth and giggles. The webbing between her fingers extends almost to her knuckles, a pale, translucent green.
"Osbert, get off me, you behemoth."
O'Neill does not laugh with Marin. His eyes are fixed on her affected hand. Noticing, Marin slips her hands into the pockets of her skirt.
"What are you staring at, peddler boy?"
Her teasing is accompanied by the batting of eyelashes, a blatant attempt to distract O'Neill from what he has seen. With a scowl, O'Neill pushes Osbert aside, and it is no small feat to move an agitated 100-pound wyvern. He stands up, filthy and frowning.
"Show me your hands, Marin."
"No."
Her lower lip protrudes in an unusually charming pout. He grabs at her arm and tries to pull her hand from its hiding place. She lets out a shriek.
What is all this?
A voice booms, silencing everything, right down to the last bird in the hedges. Scarf approaches like a slow-moving thundercloud, his typically jolly expression absent from his bushy bearded face.
O'Neill! Have I brought you up to accost young ladies and thereby cause them to rent the air with tones befitting a tribe of banshees? Not at all, sir.
O'Neill steps away from Merrin and stands as straight and solemn as a soldier. Scarf taps O'Neill's elbow with his ebony walking stick.
What have you to say to the lady? I beg your pardon, Merrin,
O'Neill says crisply.
Now, boy, since you are remembering your manners, perhaps you could show the ladies our recent acquisitions. The Turkish collection would certainly spark their interest.
Finally, a smile blooms between Scarf's fluffy mustache and beard.
How we have missed you, dearest girls!
He lays a hand on one of my cheeks and one of Marin's and sighs like a king over his treasure hoard.
In all my days, in all this wide world, never have I seen such lovely girls, except for one.
Auntie Verity, Marin volunteers.
Intelligent as well as beautiful, so you are.
His laugh is a low rumble.
Enough of your blather, Auntie says from behind her bow. Come now, Ezra, and have tea with me while the children look at the wares.
He bows to us.
Your most humble servant.
Arm in arm, Scarf and Auntie walk toward the cottage, their footsteps perfectly aligned.
Come,
O'Neill says. All of our troubles and disputes vanish as we enter the caravan.
Be lit,
O'Neill commands as he turns the brass knob on the lantern suspended in the center of the room. An intense golden light floods every corner. I squint until the light fades to a more comfortable glow. The caravan is magnificent. From hooks and pegs hang glass beads and strings of pearls, pendants of gold and enamel work, chains of silver and belts of leather as soft as a kitten's belly. Spoons carved from wood, plain and sturdy. Fishing lures and lutes, lamps and baskets. Dazzling ornaments and common kitchen knives. Shelves of bottled spices and stoppered glass vials filled by Auntie and me last spring, holding curatives. At the far end, the curtained bed stands in tapestried glory, its fat feather mattress covered with a crazy quilt of velvet and silks. As always, O'Neill mocks our wide-eyed amazement. To him, it is simply home and work. To us, it is beautiful and wild and exciting.
Here,
he says, pulling a richly lacquered chest out from beneath the sumptuous bed. He turns a key and the lid springs open.
We met a prince of the Ottoman Empire last month. He had been visiting a cousin in Philadelphia. He fell in love with the cousin's kitchen girl. He said she had eyes like stars and skin as fair as goat's milk. He sold us everything he'd brought from his faraway palaces so that he could buy her a little house beside the sea. His soul, he said, belonged to his bride, and he needed no other treasure but her.
Oh, how romantic, Merrin declares.
Wait until she loses her looks and her cheer after bearing him a dozen rowdy sons. How romantic that will be, sister, I say. Merrin and I sit on the Persian-carpeted floor and await O'Neill's presentation, for he is a natural showman and relishes any opportunity to perform. He peers into the trunk with a devilish grin, humming what must be a Turkish melody, slowly rifling through the contents. Suddenly, with a flourish, he presents us with a pair of pointy-toed yellow silk slippers.
Behold! The shoes of Prince Asil, great prince of Anatolia, skilled in music, hunting, and the wooing of ladies both dark and fair. Note the rubies on the toes.
Lovely.
Merrin says, taking one of the shoes from him. She removes a leather slipper and slips her foot into the prince's shoe.
What do you think?
They match your eyes, my lady,
O'Neill says roguishly.
Marin smacks his arm. You'll have yellow eyes if you do not mind yourself. Yellow, purple, black, and blue. One by one, O'Neill presents the prince's treasures. He sets them on the floor around us. We marvel at the copper coffee set, the bejeweled dagger, the brass candle holders, the embroidered robes, the jewelry box with the tiny silver turtle inside. Anatolia, I will never see such a place, Marin says. There is no regret in her words.
I will take you to Anatolia, O'Neill says, when we are 20 and no one can tell us what to do or where to go. I will take you both. We will see London and Paris. We will camp in deserts and on mountaintops and float upon the Dead Sea waters. We will ride elephants and camels and eat strange dishes and drink strange wines. I will douse you in the perfumes of the Orient and cover you with silken saris and pierce your noses with diamonds and pierce your ears with pearls.
Marin and I exchange a look.
Keeping secrets, are you? O'Neill asks. From your best friend in the world? Your almost brother?
Biting her lip, Marin removes one royal shoe and stretches her foot toward O'Neill. See for yourself. She fans her odd toes, showing webbing that belongs on the foot of a frog, not the foot of a young lady. He grabs her foot.
It is nothing, he says. I have seen worse things cured. I once saw a pig-headed man transformed into an ordinary banker, and on a Tuesday, no less.
It is far too warm in here, Marin says. She removes her other shoe and pelts O'Neill in the chest with it. Last one to the wishing pool is a slimy newt. In the moment before we chase after Marin, O'Neill grabs my hand.
I will see that she is cured, he vows. Trust me, Clara.
And then we are running through the forest, and once again I am wishing that I could trust in O'Neill's promise, wishing that he could be the hero of the story of Marin's life, as he was once the hero of our games of make-believe. Chapter 3. The bonfire blazes. The visiting village children dance around it, their small feet kicking and stepping to the music of Auntie's violin. Their parents sit on blankets nearby or stand beside the long trestle tables sampling peculiar pastries and miniature star-shaped cakes. An hour ago, Scarf and O'Neill set the tables themselves with brocaded cloths, silver candlesticks, and box after box of sweets and savories pulled from the depths of the caravan. I slip a mysterious pastry into my mouth, wondering about its origin. Wondering if it will be stale and I will have to swallow it for good manners' sake. I wondered for nothing. It is delicious. Despite the warmth of the summer evening, each bite cools the palate like snow, while pleasing the tongue with curious flavors. Lemon and sage, honey and black pepper. My heart is light and heavy at the same time. Light because of the music and the 99 sparkling lanterns hanging from posts and tree branches, and the laughter of my sister as old Mr. Fig whirls her about. Heavy because tomorrow morning, Scarf and O'Neill will hitch Job and January to the wagon and leave our mountain. Heavy because, for all of O'Neill's paging through books, he has found no remedy for Marin. And I know he will not, for I have spent many long nights searching those same tomes while Auntie and Marin slept. O'Neill pulls me to my feet.
Worry bird, he teases, do you not trust me to do as I have sworn?
In his arms, my heart races. His spicy Christmas scent, the sparkle of his blue eyes, things that have always given me familial comfort, are suddenly unsettling and unfamiliar. Is it the magic of the setting, I wonder, or something else? All I know is that I cannot move and do not want to. But then he tugs me toward the dancers.
Nothing like a jig to chase one's cares away, he says with a wink.
I stumble along behind him. Spoken like a true Irishman.
Or a German, a Frenchman, an Italian, or a Swede, he laughs. Whatever I may be.
And then we are dancing. To me, the dance is as magical as one of O'Neill's hat tricks, for it makes joy appear out of thin air. When the moon is over the apple orchard, a flash of lightning and rumble of thunder send the villagers scurrying home. Wasn't that convenient? I say to O'Neill as he plops to the ground between Marin and me. The firelight reveals his impish grin.
Am I to blame that your mountain folk do not care for my fireworks? I try so hard to entertain, but alas, not everyone appreciates my art.
Marin lays her head on his shoulder, her unbraided hair spilling down his shirt front like a many-tiered waterfall. You, O'Neill, are a mischief, she says fondly. The look he gives her is full of tenderness. An arrow of jealousy pierces my chest.
What have we here?
Booms Scarf as he and Auntie approach arm in arm.
A rare set of conjoined triplets?
His laughter echoes through the cooling night air, rebounds off the bumpy surface of the moon. Scarf unfolds two wooden chairs he'd been carrying under his arm. He and Auntie settle into them, their shoulders touching, their wrinkled fingers entwined. Tell us the story, Marin says, of how we were almost triplets. Please?
Again, moans O'Neill. Must we hear it every time Scarf and I come to visit?
Hush now, Auntie says. I know for a fact that we have not heard the tale for 3 years now, and it is one of my favorites.
From the pocket of his pinstriped suit coat, Scarf retrieves his wooden pipe. The bowl is carved with the fierce face of a bear. It used to frighten me when I was small. From another pocket, he withdraws a black leather pouch of tobacco. In his habitual manner, Scarf dips the pipe into the pouch, uses two fingers to tamp the tobacco down, and then lights it with a flint. He takes his time, most likely to make Marin squirm. She squirms.
It will be daylight before you manage to tell the story, she whines.
Scarf laughs.
Very well. I will begin.
He blows three smoke rings and clears his throat. Groaning, Marin throws herself back onto the grass.
Well, Miss Impatient, Scarf scolds, if you are going to take a nap, I will not waste my breath with storytelling.
Auntie pinches him hard enough to elicit an
ouch. Long, long ago, he begins, when you girls were babes in arms, I drove the wagon up to the gates of a beautiful church. It was early November, and I was chilled clear to my bones. A cold snap had come up, you see. So although I was in the south, the weather was terribly disagreeable. The church stood tall against the gray skies like a castle of old. Billows of smoke floated up from the rectory's chimney. So I thought to myself that perhaps I could find warm refuge there. I had traded goods with priests before for shelter and a hot meal. So I tied my horses to the iron fence. Their names were Frederick and February. A fine pair of horses they were. Frederick was a bay and stood—
For goodness sake! Marin says with a huff. Skip the horse part.
Scarf chortles and blows more smoke rings, clearly relishing the hassle he is giving Marin.
So, where was I? Oh, yes, the churchyard. I walked in and headed for the rectory, skirting the gravestones out of respect. That's when I heard the most dreadful wailing. At first I thought I'd disturbed one of the residents of the graveyard, so unearthly was the sound. Despite my goosebumps, I followed the wailing around the side of the church and through a gate into what must have been a most magnificent garden in the spring or summer. Past the leafless rose bushes and blackberry patches, underneath the bare branches of one of the largest apple trees I have ever seen, there knelt a black-robed man. His back was to me, and he was hunched over, and the terrible sound was coming from him.
Scarf leans back and shuts his eyes.
I can see it plain as day, that scene. I still dream of it almost every night.
Auntie smiles and pats his arm.
I wondered if I should disturb the man. His grief was so raw. His cry is so full of anguish. But I could not leave any creature alone to suffer so, neither man nor beast. Pardon me, father, I said. Can I help you somehow? He turned toward me then, his face swollen with weeping, and held out his arms.
Merrin grabs one of my hands and one of O'Neill's. Her face glows with excitement.
There, in a willow basket, wrapped in a tangle of rags, lay a baby no bigger than the scrawniest of barn cats, fast asleep, oblivious to the priest's carrying on. Thanks be to God, the priest shouted. Thanks to Our Lady and all the saints and angels on high. Well, I took a step back. Thought he must be a lunatic, or too fond of the communion wine, or some such thing. You must take the child. It is the will of the Lord, he said. I stepped back again. Father, I said, I am afraid I do not comprehend your meaning. The tears rolled down his face like rain down window glass. He said, My brother Seamus is buried beneath this apple tree. He died 40 years ago today. That is why I came here this evening. And what did I find but this helpless babe, and him with the same heart-shaped birthmark on his chin as our Seamus had?
Scarf pauses so that all may turn to look at O'Neill's chin. O'Neill rolls his eyes, but he is smiling too.
Take him, the priest begged. I am too old for infants, and I would not send a half-dead dog to our county orphanage. I could not speak, so aghast I was. Then the child opened his eyes and looked right through me. As if compelled by forces unseen, I opened my arms wide. The priest did not wait 1 second before shoving the basket into my grasp. Then he kissed my cheeks. Glory be to God, he said, shaking like a leaf. Bless you, my son. Bless you through all the ages, forever and ever. He smiled from ear to ear. He had but 3 teeth to his name, I swear. I watched him limp off to the church, and there I was, left holding a baby of all things. I glanced at the marker in the roots of the apple tree. Seamus O'Neill, it said. Rest in peace. I looked at the child, and he looked at me. I said, Lad, you surely don't look like a Seamus to me. So O'Neill it shall be. And he reached a little hand up and yanked my beard. Unfortunately, I fell in love with the creature then and there.
Dear little baby O'Neill, Merrin teases. Sweet little beard tugger. O'Neill nudges her with his shoulder and she collapses in a fit of giggling. Tapping his pipe upside down against the ground, Scarf continues.
Much as I loved the child, I did not think the life of a roving peddler suitable for him. So when spring came, I traveled to Pennsylvania with a mission. I planned to give him to Verity as a brother for the 2 girls she'd adopted. He'd have a good home, good food, lots of love, and woods to roam. But O'Neill had other plans. Turns out he was the only baby ever to dislike Verity Amsel in the history of mankind.
Go on, Auntie says, laughing. He liked me fine. But the boy knew his place, and his place was with you. He cried so loudly every time you left the room that I knew I'd be deaf in a day if you left him with me.
So it was. O'Neill chose me and a traveler's life, and truly, I would not have had it any other way.
Scarf says with a wistful grin and a fat tear in the corner of his eye. He did not want 2 sisters. That is why he howled so, I offer.
True enough, O'Neill says. Who could stand having to live in the same house with girls like you?
I wish you'd stay forever,
I think. I wish that I would not wish so often. Chapter 4. In the morning, Scarf and O'Neill are gone. It is how they always leave, quietly, without goodbyes, without tears or promises to return on a certain day or in a certain month. They will come back before they go south for the winter, I am sure. Before breakfast, when I rise alone to feed the chickens, I find a folded scrap of paper in my boot beside the door. "Remember my promise and fret not," it says. It is signed with a fancy O, so full of swirls it reminds me of a tornado. I press the paper to my heart as if it were a love letter. Is it wrong to feel so happy about a simple note when my sister is on the brink of becoming half fish? The hens scurry back and forth and cluck with excitement when they see me. I scatter corn for them and watch them peck and scratch. They are happy because their puny brains do not allow for what-ifs or guilt or wishing. But I do not wish to be a chicken any more than I wish to become a stork, because then I would not have a glorious bit of paper signed with a swirling O inside my pocket. When I return to the cottage, Gretel Goodling is waiting for me on the doorstep, her cheeks rosy from her early morning hike up the mountain. She shifts her weight from foot to foot with all the impatience one would expect from a 13-year-old girl sent on an errand. "Is your brother ill again?" I ask.
"Yes, another fever and cough," she says. "Mama wants me to ask Miss Verity to come down to him. He's that bad."
I lead Gretel inside and call for Auntie. While Auntie gathers her medicines, Gretel and I share a pot of tea.
"Have you heard about the traveling show?" Gretel asks. "Mama says they'll be selling unreliable medicines, but that we can go for the music and such. It's tonight in the Pinckney's fallow field."
Marin enters the kitchen, yawning and fastening the top button of her blouse with lace-gloved fingers.
"Did you say something about a show?"
Gretel repeats the news, her enthusiasm increasing by the minute.
"We must go too, Clara," Marin says,
now wide awake and matching Gretel's excitement.
"We never get shows here."
"Well, hardly ever, and don't say that O'Neill's antics count, because they do not."
"I am not interested in seeing silver-tongued salesmen and hearing bawdy songs sung by nearly undressed ladies," I say.
"We can entertain ourselves at home in a more appropriate manner."
"Well, I'm going," Marin says. "Unchaperoned, if you will not come with me."
She knows the word unchaperoned makes me cringe.
"Auntie, please tell Clara that she must go see the traveling show with me tonight. I might never get another chance, after all."
"You should go with Marin, Clara."
Auntie covers her basket of herbs and bottles with a clean towel.
"Widen your horizons, dear. Dance with the village boys and enjoy your youth."
"There, it's settled,"
Marin says proudly,
"and perhaps O'Neill would like to come. Where is he? Out seeing to his horses?"
"They've gone," I say, "in their usual way."
"Scarf doesn't care for a fuss," Auntie says, "so we won't pout over it, will we, my girls?"
Marin pouts.
"At least you have the show to look forward to, sister," I say, even though I am not looking forward to it one bit.
I pour a cup of tea and set it before her.
"And they will be back before you know it."
"True enough," Auntie says.
She picks up her basket.
"Come along now, Gretel, and we'll see what's to be done about your brother."
O'Neill's note crinkles inside my pocket as I cross the kitchen to refill the teapot, a secret treasure hidden among the folds of my everyday garment. If I must go to the show, I will carry it with me. It is a more than adequate consolation. A section of Farmer Pinckney's field is marked off with flaming torches, each as tall as a man. Within this boundary, rows of benches face a raised stage. Above the stage, lanterns hang from a wire and cast a warm glow on the plank floor. The villagers gather at the boundaries, seeming to hesitate, as if going any farther would be equivalent to entering a fairy circle or haunted place. Only a few young people venture to the benches. They are wearing their best clothes, and so is Marin. Whether it's to impress one another or in honor of the rare event, I do not know. Marin pulls me by the sleeve of my second-best dress until we reach the center of the third-row bench. Immediately, Simon Shumsky and Daniel Roberts take seats beside us. Daniel sits close enough to me that I can feel the warmth of his thigh through the fabric of my dress and petticoat. His breath makes no secret of the fact that he had onions for supper, washed down with beer. I slide closer to my sister and make use of my fan. Simon flirts with Marin, and she flirts back. She is only playing, but he has asked her to marry him at least 3 times this year. He is neither very bright nor very handsome, but he is rich and determined. I wonder if she would have said yes to him someday, for all the wrong reasons, had she not been destined to become a mermaid. The thought of Marin's future form sends a shiver of dread through my body. How long will she be able to remain with us on the mountain? And who will take her to the sea when the time comes? I could never be brave enough to take her there alone. I have heard far too many stories of perilous roads and dangerous strangers. And beyond that, how could I keep her safe and hidden? Perhaps with O'Neill's aid? I stare at Marin's pretty profile and try to comfort myself with the truth. My sister is not afraid of becoming a mermaid. She has spoken of it since we were very young, and never with dismay. Quite the opposite, in fact. I think the romance of life in an underwater kingdom appeals to her greatly. If I were more like her, I might relish the thought of the feathers and wings I will grow one day, if or when I become a stork, instead of accepting my possible fate without joy, as I do now. The music of a flute wafts over the crowd and distracts me from my woeful reverie. Finally, the villagers dare to step into the bounds of the show, finding seats and shushing noisy children and spouses. Near the back of the platform, a red velvet curtain parts, and a woman walks to center stage. Her skin is the color of caramel, and her small, lithe body is wrapped in a sunset of silks. Gold rings adorn her ears, and a diamond sparkles on her nostril. She spreads her arms wide and begins to sing. She sings in deeply accented English, a song about a caged bird's longing for freedom. Her voice soars and dips like a bird in flight. Suddenly, or so it seems, the song is over. The audience applauds and cheers. Beside me, Daniel Roberts whistles, and then looks at me sheepishly and apologizes. A short, stout, impeccably dressed gentleman takes the stage. He sweeps his top hat off his balding head and bows low. Then he says, "Ladies and gentlemen, I, Dr. George Wilhelm Hieronymus Lewis Balthazar Phipps, welcome you here tonight. You have just had the great privilege of hearing the beautiful songstress, Madame Soraya of Gorjanastani, the darling of the crowned heads of Europe and Asia. And now I present to you the handsome, the masterful, the celebrated Jasper Armand and his captivating violin." Dr. Phipps steps behind the curtain. He is replaced on the stage by a tall young man with a boyish face and a mop of brassy curls. He has the same eyes as the singer, golden brown, like those of a mountain lion. He lifts the violin and, as promised, the audience is captivated. Jasper plays with abandon, his face changing with each melody's mood. He moves from gentle lullaby to mournful ballad to rollicking jig. The jig brings the crowd to their feet and into the aisles. Simon and Marin twirl and canter and laugh. I am pulled and spun about by Daniel until I am quite dizzy.
"Take your seats, if you please,"
Dr. Phipps calls out when the music ends.
"The great Jasper Armand shall entertain you again momentarily," he says. "First, I must deliver unto you a message of the greatest import. As a practitioner of the medical arts, I am bound by conscience to speak to you plainly, to reveal the deep secrets of healing I have gathered. Open your ears to the sound of my voice, ladies and gentlemen.
Dr. Phipps paces like a wildcat and extols like a preacher.
Have you aches and pains, anxieties or doldrums, skin rashes, stomach ailments or digestive weakness? Have you women's problems, coughs or colds, wheezes or sneezes, palsies or poxes, poor memory or trouble sleeping? Would you like to feel young again? Behold, I bring you glad tidings. I, Dr. George Wilhelm Hieronymus Louis Balthazar Phipps, possess the miracle you have been longing for. For every health issue you might be facing, I have developed an effective curative.
He pauses for a moment, using a bright blue silk handkerchief to dab his damp brow.
How, you might ask, could one man find the cures for every sickness known to humankind? Well, my fine folks, I have consulted with physicians, scholars, shamans, wise men, wizards, scientists, and men of faith from across the globe. And the fruit of these studies is what I offer you here tonight. Dr. Phipps's special formulas. I offer you balms, elixirs, pills, and syrups, each suited for your specific affliction and priced fairly so that I can help as many folks as possible.
His expression of earnestness is every bit as theatrical as his speech. He spreads his hands in a gesture of appeal.
Do not suffer another day, I beseech you. Visit the tables behind the stage after the show and purchase your new healthy life tonight. We also offer fine soaps, tooth powders, painted fans, and fine gifts from faraway lands. Now, do not hesitate, my dear friends. Your miracle awaits you.
I know he is a liar, for Auntie has warned us well of such men. But he is a skilled liar. And there is no way that I can stem the tide of customers rushing to buy his sham cures. As if to contrast to the hectic movement, Jasper plays a mellow tune on guitar. Simon takes Marin by the gloved hand.
I'll buy you something pretty, Miss Marin, whatever you choose.
That is very kind of you, she says. My sister is never one to refuse a gift. I follow close behind Marin and Simon, losing Daniel in the throng. Every resident of the mountain, except Auntie, must be here tonight, and most of them seem extremely anxious to waste their money. When we reach the tables, Marin points out a pair of embroidered silk gloves. Madame Soraya, now shop mistress, picks them up.
Try them. They will look beautiful with your ivory skin, she says. Give me your hands and I will show you.
As quick as a striking snake, Madame Soraya takes hold of Marin's hands and pulls off her lace gloves. I gasp, and so does the show woman. It is too late for my sister to hide her affliction from Madame Soraya. I look about, terrified that others might have seen. Auntie has kept our bits of magic and our pet wyvern secret all these years. She has warned us of the possible consequences of revealing our uniqueness. The loss of our home, our friends, and perhaps our lives. To my relief, no one is staring at us. Even Simon seems not to have noticed Marin's hands. He stands half turned away from the table, deep in conversation with the village mason. Madame Soraya says,
I have seen this before. If you will meet me when the show is over, I will take you to Dr. Phipps. I am sure he can help you, child.
It's nothing, Marin says, escaping Madame Soraya's grip and hiding her hands behind her back. Just something that runs in my family, like freckles or large ears.
You come and meet us, Madame Soraya insists. It is a matter of life and death, child. You know this as well as I.
Marin turns away from the table. I want to go home, Simon. They have nothing I want. Her pretty face is pale and her lower lip trembles.
I will drive you home in my father's carriage,
Simon says as he guides us through the crowd. I could not call myself a gentleman if I allowed you girls to walk 2 miles up the mountain in the dark.
Thank you, Simon, I say. We appreciate your kindness.
Marin is uncharacteristically quiet during the ride home, no matter how hard Simon tries to amuse her. Poor Simon.
Later, safe at home in our shared bed, Marin says,
Perhaps you were right to want to stay home tonight. Perhaps I should try to be more sensible, like you.
I roll over to face her. What fun would the world be if everyone was sensible like me? I say.
What fun would I have if you allowed me to sit about reading all day?
You make me live, sister. You keep me from being boring and bored.
Thank you,
she says.
Still, I would like to be better. Not always horrifying you and Auntie with my bad manners.
Go to sleep, dear, I say, yawning. You may reform in the morning, if you still wish to.
She is quiet for a moment, and then whispers, I will stay home from now on, although I will most certainly hate it. I do not want to scare the boys with my scales and fins. I would rather remember them thinking me pretty.
She rolls away from me and takes my share of the blankets with her.
Good night, Clara.
Good night, I say. Truth be told, I do wish we had stayed home. And I wish the medicine show woman had not caught a glimpse of Marin's webbed fingers. I hope Marin's careless revelation is quickly forgotten and does not bring consequences upon our little family. My most fervent wish tonight, the last wish I will allow myself before surrendering to sleep, is for Madame Soraya and the dreadful medicine show to leave Lanfair Mountain before dawn and never return.
Chapter 5 August melts into September.